Okay, well, first, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come down here to what is really the sunny side of California. And also listening to all these talks today, I want to, it's probably the last scientific presentation of today, finish with what unites us all, and that is indeed what stem cells can do, their potential to differentiate. But at the same time, what is very important for stem cell is this unique property of maintaining their state, right? So they self-renew, whether it is an embryonic stem cell or an adult stem cell. It is the decision of a stem cell to self-renew or to differentiate that is under control. So what are the controls? There are many of them. Many are inside cells, but there is a very important role for external signals in what stem cells can do, and experiments that were done in fruit flies or worms, where many stem cells and their niches were characterized in great detail, have shown that if you eliminate the outside signals, the external signals that manipulate stem cells, the default of what cells are doing is to differentiate. So what the signals have to do is to maintain the self-renewing state and to block the differentiation. And this holds up for many kinds of stem cells, and as I will show you, it is also important for embryonic stem cell. This has a number of important consequences. One of them is that it explains to a large extent why it is so difficult to maintain stem cells in culture. You need to provide them with the right kind of signals to keep them self-renewing, and then to later, by removing those signals, allow them to differentiate. So the question I want to ask is, this external control, is it also true for embryonic stem cells? We know something about the ESLs. They have to be grown in complex media, feeder layers, serum, lymph, etc. I will tell you about the role of the Wnt pathway, in particular the Wnt proteins, in maintaining embryonic stem cell fate. The work that I'm going to discuss is to a large extent based on very detailed knowledge about what the Wnt pathway looks like inside cells. There are many components of Wnt signaling that have been identified over the years that are either implicated in normal development. Some of them are also implicated in cancer quite strongly, in particular proteins like beta-catenin, which can be an oncogene, the APC, tumor suppressor gene. You've heard earlier from Katrina about GSK3 also playing a role when it is absent in cancer. So the Wnt signaling pathway is typically displayed in two different states. One of them when there's no Wnt signal yet. At that moment, the beta-catenin protein, again the key player in the internal signal transduction of Wnt signaling, is outside of the nucleus and it doesn't do much. But when the Wnt protein, the ligand, comes along, it starts to bind to receptors. It will then disrupt this so-called destruction complex. And as a consequence of that signal, the beta-catenin protein now goes to the nucleus, and it binds to a DNA binding protein called TCF. And the complex between beta-catenin and TCF is very important in the activation of target genes of the Wnt pathway. There are many different targets, many different cell types have also different targets, but it has allowed over the years to characterize Wnt signaling in great detail because of the existence of very suitable Wnt reporters. At the same time, what my own lab has been working on for many years, in particular Carl Willard when he was still in the lab, is to actually purify the Wnt proteins in an active form. And it has been difficult for many years until Carl realized that the Wnt proteins are modified by lipids. That explains a lot of the typical behavior of a Wnt protein. They are very hydrophobic and difficult to manipulate in the absence of any detergent. But it's also very important for the in vivo behavior of Wnt proteins. These are typically short-range acting signals that probably work in the context of membranes by the palmitates and the other lipid modification, palmitoleate, probably inserting into the membrane. It is true for many, if not all, of the Wnts, and the palmitates are actually essential for Wnt signaling. At the same time, we have these Wnt reporters where we now take the TCF binding sites on the DNA and we hook them up to either LACG and then or GFP, and then we can visualize Wnt signaling in vivo. And that's very important. You can now, when you are interested in stem cells, visualize where the Wnt responsive cells are in the animal and to see whether those co-localize with presumed stem cells. And let me just give you one example of these reporters and what they show you in development. This is a TGF-LAC-Z reporter, where you can see that in the early mouse embryo, this is in the blastocyst, that there is very active Wnt signaling in cells that are called the inner cell mass. And as we all know, embryonic stem cells are derived from the inner cell mass. If you would look at other tissues like the intestine, work done by Hans Clevers, also just like me from the Netherlands, or in the blood or in the skin, in the mammary gland, you can also visualize Wnt signaling in exquisite detail. And if you're interested in this business, I can highly recommend to you to use those reporters. Now let me return to those early embryos and the role of Wnt signaling. I want to put it in the context of what happens during normal mouse or in general mammalian development. So early embryos, they start out as a clump of cells called the morula, turns into a blastocyst with the inner cell mass. Then after implantation, the embryo starts to develop further into a primitive ectodermal layer. And then subsequently, you get the development of the three germ layers of an embryo: endoderm, mesoderm, and ectoderm. So let's look at what these reporters now visualize about whether Wnt signaling is active during those various stages of development. You see that early that Wnt signaling is on in the inner cell mass. And then interestingly, when the embryo proceeds into what's called the epiblast and the formation of the primitive ectoderm, Wnt signaling now stops. And then later, when the gastrula develops and you get the development of mesoderm, etc., Wnt signaling is now on again. And this led us now to follow the activity of Wnt signaling in various forms of embryonic stem cells. Again, based on these data here of the Wnt signal being on, off, and then on again. Work was done by Derek ten Berge and Tim Blaukamp, two postdocs in the lab. And there's an interesting correlation between these two different stages of development, the blastocyst and the epiblast, in terms of the existence of various kinds of embryonic stem cells. The true embryonic stem cells that we are all familiar with from the mouse, they grow as these typical clumps with a highly refractile edge, and they come from the early blastocyst. These cells are, as we all know, pluripotent, they're germline competent, and they are clonogenic in cell culture, so you can disperse the cells and grow them at very low density. Now, there's a second kind of stem cell derived from embryo, and people now call those in general epiblast stem cells, EPSC. Those are coming from the later stage embryo, and they are to some extent pluripotent, but they're not germline competent, and they are not clonogenic. So given the fact that Wnt signaling is active in the normal inner cell mass of the embryo and not active in the epiblast, we've been following the role of the Wnt protein itself now in the generation of either embryonic stem cells or epiblast stem cells. And this has been our approach, using the protein itself, but importantly also, we have a variety of Wnt antagonists available. And one of them that is very useful is what we call the Frizzled CRD. This is a soluble domain of the Wnt receptor and soaks up active Wnt protein. So you basically block signaling at the level of the ligand. Reporter ES cells, clonogenic assays. And we have been very strongly emphasizing to look at very minimal requirements of growth for ES cells. No serum, no feeders, because that makes it complex. So let me first show you that if you take embryonic stem cells and now carrying one of these Wnt reporters, the GFP, that indeed the Wnt pathway is on. So this is somewhat dimly showing you an embryonic stem cell culture with the typical refractile edges. And that is positive for Wnt signaling as detected with the reporter. When we add the Wnt protein to these cultures, we see that the reporter becomes more active. But conversely, when we block Wnt signaling by the antagonist, you see that the reporter is not active anymore, and likewise the cells now start to differentiate somewhat. Now subsequently, we could establish that if you indeed take ES cells and you now plate them at low density for a number of generations in the presence of this Wnt antagonist, the Frizzled CRD, that the cells lose their pluripotent morphology, and that over a number of passages in culture that you cannot derive ES cells anymore, that the cells have lost their clonogenic behavior. So this implies that the Wnt protein is indeed made by embryonic stem cells, and that turns out to be the case. It also applies, perhaps, that feeder layers or serum, normally used to maintain ES cells, can contain active protein, and both also turn out to be the case. I should add in passing that there are many different twins, 19 different family members. It's not so easy to pinpoint the presence of the protein, but from these assays we think that they are actually widely expressed by, for example, feeder layers. Now you may wonder, can we now use this active wind protein to establish de novo ES cells? And that turns out to be the case. We can also maintain, as it turns out, embryonic stem cells, existing lines, in the presence of the wind protein, just with adding the LIF, but nothing else. No feeders, no serum. We can passage embryonic stem cells for at least 4 to 6 passages in culture at low density with just 2 purified proteins, LIF and the wind. These embryonic stem cells are germline competent. You inject them into a host blastocyst and you drive mice from them, and then the segregation of the coat color in the next generation can tell you whether these are mice that have been completely derived from the injected ES cells, and that is shown by this experiment. Yes, we can also make more embryonic stem cells by adding the wind protein to them. These are blastocysts that have been put into culture, and in the presence of the wind, you see that they grow out, and we can make more of those lines, in particular from also mice that are sometimes more cumbersome to derive embryonic stem cells from, like the C57 black. We get these nicely growing embryonic stem cell cultures with the wind protein, the positive for the OCT4 marker and many other markers that are typical for the pluripotent state of ES cells. So let me finally now go back to the correlation between wind sickling and the state of the ES cells and how that relates to the expression of certain marker genes for primitive states and primitive fates or more advanced states like here. So if you've heard a couple of times during this meeting today, there are markers for early stage embryonic stem cells or the inner cell mass, and those include the famous NANOC and OCT4 genes. But then later, once the embryo implants and starts to proceed to become an epiblast, there are other markers coming up, and one of them is FGF5. There's another one called OTX2. These are typically markers for ectodermal or early neuroectodermal differentiation. So what now is the consequence of blocking the wind signal on the expression of these markers? We found that very early pluripotency genes are not so much affected by blocking wind signaling using the Frizzled-8 CRD markers, but that the genes that are typical for inner cell mass, like NANOC and REX1, they are actually strongly downregulated by blocking the wind signal. Okay, and that implies that you have an active wind signal around to maintain the expression of NANOC or REX1. And likewise, when we start to block wind signaling in these embryonic stem cells, and we look at the expression of the ectodermal markers, so these are the differentiation markers, you see that they go up. So FGF5 and OTX2, neuroectodermal markers, are induced by the absence of the wind signal. Now, this transition from embryonic stem cells into epiblast stem cells has recently been shown by Austin Smith's group to be, he was able to mimic that in cell culture by taking ES cells and growing them in particular culture conditions by removing serum, removing the LIF, and then adding another growth factor, basic FGF. And what he was able to show in this paper, Chu et al., Cell 2008, is that if you grow ES cells and you culture them under these conditions, that they start to differentiate into epiblast stem cells. And what we, of course, try to do now is to see whether that stop could be actually blocked by adding the wind protein. And that actually turns out to be the case. So we start from ES cells. You put them into culture media that normally would allow them to differentiate into an epiblast state. But if you do that experiment in the presence of the wind protein, just again, the purified protein, the cells maintain their primitive ES cell fate and also the colony shape. So therefore, it brings me again to the same series of conclusions, and that is that in the absence of the wind protein, that ES cells, they acquire conditions and properties that are typical for the progression of an embryo to proceed from a primitive blastocyst state to a more differentiated epiblast state and the production of ectodermal cells. And it shows you that the experiments that we have done in cell culture go hand in hand with the activity of the Wnt pathway in the early embryo itself. I showed you a couple of times now that Wnt signaling is active very early in embryogenesis and then is shut off, most likely to allow the embryo to proceed to the next step. The cells are then in a different state. Wnt signaling then becomes active again, but rather than turning the cells back into the blastocyst state, it now allows the cells to progress yet further into the mesodermal differentiation into an early gastrula. So what I'm trying to say here is not only Wnt proteins are very useful in manipulating embryonic stem cells, but also that that activity reflects what Wnt signaling is doing normally during early mouse development and presumably also during human development. So this work has a number of implications. We would say that in general, embryonic stem cells, but also, as we and many other groups have found, that other stem cells, I'm now talking about adult stem cells, that their self-renewing state is controlled by outside signals, that Wnts are among the signals that are very important to maintain the primitive self-renewing state, and that they block the differentiation. That in embryonic stem cells, rather than being autonomous in the self-renewing state, that they actually do require signals, including the Wnts. We can probably make yet more embryonic stem cells using the Wnt protein also from other species. I also want to show data, or don't have the time, that iPS cells, as we found out, and also some human hair cells also require the Wnt protein. And in general, I want to make that point that the external control of the Wnt of stem cells by an external signal is probably important in preventing them from becoming cancer cells. And conversely, as we know, activation of the Wnt pathway within stem cells can readily lead to cancer, as has been shown for colon cancer and a variety of other human tumors. Finally, I want to acknowledge the people who have been doing this work. Dirk ten Berge, who is now at the Stem Cell Institute at the University of Rotterdam in Holland. Tim Blauwkamp, Wouter Kool, and Carl Willert, who is now here at UCSD. And I want to acknowledge the support that we have been getting from CIRM and also from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Thank you for your attention.